All right, so today we have an incredibly special guest, Jaron Lanier, who is essentially a computer scientist, a musician, an artist, a philosopher, and also, you know, probably the father of virtual reality. I mean, you can argue about the terminology, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. that was something very important to you that you helped work on and mm-hmm. initiate. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Oh, hey, great to be here.
Excellent. So, I mean, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, I mean, you've just written a book, that sort of you are not a gadget.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the thinking behind that as we start to explore a little bit more about you and, mm-hmm. and your perception of computation and social
okay.
networking.
Well, I have a concern that computers are changing human experience and will do so more. Mm-hmm. And the way that happens, though, isn't predetermined. There's a way that computer scientists can sort of steer it. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that the way we've been steering it is not really optimal for people.
Okay.
I'm a little concerned that we've tended to prefer some designs lately that I don't think bring out the best in people. And you could argue my standards are too high. There's sort of this argument, like, what's it to you? If it's what people are doing, then why even say anything? But I don't think it works that way. I think the way it works is that we should always be questioning ourselves and always try to think if there's something that we've missed that would be even better. Mm-hmm. And that's what the book is all about. It expresses a philosophy of computation that is probably a little distinct mm-hmm. from the mainstream at the moment. The point of view in the book doesn't really have a name, but essentially what it suggests is that computers aren't real, that software is only real once it's perceived to have done something by a person, that mm-hmm. an alien coming across a PC would just see this space heater with a pattern of bits that don't mean anything, and it's really only cultural interpretation that makes bits have meaning.
Interesting.
and starting from that philosophical point of view, which really attributes a sort of a magicness or a specialness to people as the magic experiencers that can make bits have meaning, then that proceeds to some very different takes on how software could be designed.
Absolutely.
And at the very least, what I hope people realize is that if they disagree with that point of view, there's a pretty good chance that they're sprinkling some sort of magic dust on computers and imagining mm-hmm. that something about an algorithm has a supernatural quality. So there's a sort of a philosophical game. But then that plays out, that radiates into all kinds of things like ideas about what's wrong with Facebook and all
sure.
a lot of stuff, very complex stuff.
Absolutely. Now, would it be fair to characterize this as sort of humanistic computationalism?
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I call it humanism, absolutely. A new kind of humanism. Yeah. The term humanism has meant a lot of different things over the years.
Sure.
And some of them haven't been very, they're not things that one can be sympathetic to these days. Mm. But I think humanism is a good term for what I'm up to.
Excellent. And so, of course, let's talk a little bit about virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
The question I'd ask immediately is, you know, why? What led you into thinking that is interesting to the extent to where you
wow you know the it. Virtual reality stuff happened so long ago. I mean how could it not be interesting? It's like another
Fair
it's like
enough.
Ridiculous, like that's like saying like
okay.
Virtual reality when I was a kid it just seemed like the most interesting possible thing you could do. It's like directly inventing new experience and becoming any creature you could perceive yourself to become, and redesigning the sensory motor loop of people as a form of art. Mm. Like, that stuff just to me was the most exciting thing possible.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. And it ought to be. I mean, that's like really great stuff. It's just unfolding very slowly. Mm. I found an old thing I wrote about 30 years ago. It's hard to say that. But about 30 years ago, I predicted that virtual reality would hit around 2025.
Huh, interesting.
Like the full-on thing. And that was based on sort of Moore's Law type extrapolations. And that's for the hardware. The software, who knows?
Uh-huh.
Some things seem to be coming faster, some things take longer.
Sure.
Software is always harder than hardware.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've talked a lot about that, and in some sense, the capability for humans to compose software to take advantage of, let's say, 5,000 cores, isn't there? Right. No, it just is not there. So
well, right
let's
now,
talk about that.
Yeah, right now we have this sort of crisis of too much of a good thing, which is that we have sort of more hardware than we know how to program, multi-core and so forth. And my own feeling is that a lot of the different problems with approaches to programming multi-core boil down to the following thing, that determinism is too expensive to realize at a large scale. You know, so if you want to be able to precisely program something that'll happen that's very complex, forget about problems with programming. Like, just express that thing you want to have happen. And expression is never free. There's no such thing as a free bit. Every bit is physical. Every bit spews carbon when it switches. Every bit takes up energy and mass. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. Okay. We live in a physical universe. So this act of specifying a complicated thing at a very large scale in itself becomes something expensive. And there's like this point where it's just not possible. So what you have to do is you have to have a new way of expressing what you want to have happen that's tenable in the first place. And then you can think about how to actually get it to happen. And so our initial problem is that we're thinking about programming all wrong for large scales. We're thinking too precisely, basically. We're trying to you can't micromanage at a very large scale because nobody has the wealth to do it, even Bill. You know, you can't. You have to come up with forms of approximation. And furthermore, there's a very interesting thing. Now, if you look at how nature works, nature reduces the amount of information needed to specify something as much as possible. So, I mean, if you look at the genome, it's big, but then look at a person. I mean, you know, in the context of what, like, imagine writing, like, some kind of program to describe a person. It would just be much, much larger than the genome. The genome's a really compact thing. And so what's happened is nature's found a way to configure the space of in which small changes have substantial effects, so therefore you don't need a lot of changes to describe a lot of spaces within this configuration. This gets to be a whole thing that's too would take too long to describe for a little show like this. But we need to have forms of programming in which it's plausible to describe what's crucial about what you want to have happen with brevity. And then it's plausible that we can implement it. And that's the key thing we need to take advantage of multi-core. And if you ask, do I have ideas about how to do that? Yeah, of course I do. So there used to be this. There's a thing I've been working on, this thing I called phenotropic programming, for a long time.
Interesting.
And the idea there is that you have a programming architecture that has no protocols, meaning you don't specify in advance signaling patterns between things.
Okay.
It has no named variables. But instead what it has is pattern classification schemes. So you have these different pieces that learn, that watch each other and form theories about each other and learn to anticipate each other. Now, an interesting question, what are they looking at in each other? So if you wanted to have this piece of software, some kind of module, and some other thing is going to interpret that module and learn to manipulate it without having a detailed protocol. And the reason I want to avoid a detailed protocol is the reason I just described, because at very large scales, nobody has the time to describe what should happen. Okay?
Okay.
So what is this? So pheno is surface, like the phenotype in biology. Tropic is just interaction. So it's interaction of surfaces. What is the surface of a software module that another one could measure and learn to interact with?
Well, interesting.
There is one, which is the user interface, the one invented for people. So if you can invent a piece of software that can learn to use other software based on the user interface, then you can make a network of those things that could operate each other and make a giant program that way, where each boundary is based on a user interface, so a human has at least a shot at understanding it and intervening at different points to manipulate what's going on in the system. So it takes human intervention into account. And the whole thing would run on the basis of, as I say, pattern classification. And I don't like the term AI for various reasons, but the techniques normally associated with AI. And a big network of these things can start to really do a lot. It's an interesting way to program, because at the very smallest scale, you spend a lot, and it seems like the least efficient possible way to do anything. Like, if all you want is one program to be able to use an arithmetic library, why would you want to train it to use a calculator interface? That just seems like this insane overhead.
Okay.
But when you have a million of these modules, I think it turns around and it actually becomes an efficiency, because you no longer have protocol-based bugs, and you have an ability to understand, you can intervene at different points in this very large thing.
Okay.
So I think that it's a terrible inefficiency at small scale, but an efficiency at large scale.
Interesting. Now, when you get out to the large scale, mm-hmm. though, do you worry about sort of control? So in other words, I know that, you know, this, you're not necessarily talking about, you know, the singularity and all of a sudden these programs become so intelligent and able to understand patterns and readapt and all of a sudden you're building this gigantic system.
Yeah, don't worry about that.
Exactly. So we'll talk about that. I know that that's a,
it's been great for my friend Ray's career.
Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Yes, he's really into the singularity.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's his calling card. Good for him. Hey, listen.
But we're going to get there because I want to ask you some questions about that. But so complex software that can be essentially composed in a simplistic way.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually kind of goes back to your notion of, you call it kind of, I wouldn't say, it's sort of symbolic communication. Let's talk about post-symbolic communication, which this is sort of related to from the standpoint.
It could be a little related, yeah.
Okay.
It's a little different. That's an idea. That was an idea that I started exploring a long time ago, and I still don't fully know what it means, but the idea is that if you're in immersive virtual worlds and you can turn into different creatures, you can turn into a giraffe or an alien or something, and all kinds of different things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, I think you start to experience potentially a different way of communicating with other people than what we've experienced before, where... let's say, just to use the simplest example, teapot, since teapots are the iconic thing in computer graphics history.
Sure.
So you can say the word teapot, and it's a symbol for teapot, but if you actually make the teapot, woof, here's the teapot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something more direct about that, because you're creating a part of the objective reality that people share, just like anything else in reality. So it's like something other people can share, even if they don't speak the same language, they don't have the word. There's something there that's shared.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something outside of language. Maybe calling it post-symbolic was a bit much, but it's not the same thing anymore.
Sure.
And if you go down that path, things get very interesting. So, for instance, let's suppose... one of the things that you use abstractions for is categories, where you say, well, red stuff.
Okay.
So the idea of red covers this infinity of potential red things instead of just a particular set of red things. So it's a different kind of redness. It's like this infinite redness that you can get because you use the abstract red, right?
Okay.
But imagine that there's like a bucket. You put your head inside it. Inside, it's infinitely big. And there, collected, rotating about you, is every red thing that's ever been, billions of them. That's yet another kind of red. That's a third kind of red. It's neither infinite exactly, but it's much larger than any specific set we had before. And then you can just look at them and immediately perceive, well, this is what all these things have in common.
Interesting.
And so that's yet another kind of red. So this gets into philosophy and epistemology, but what I think virtual reality does is it brings up a new kind of basis of communication that's neither concrete nor symbolic, but this sort of very flexible or fluid concreteness that leads to different kind of meaning. And I think that's really interesting, and that there's going to be tremendous adventures that come out of it.
Interesting. And I mean, just out of, you know, based on a sort of what you said earlier, I mean, would you see the potential for, in some sense, a 3D programming experience? So I'm a developer, and I stick a bucket on my head.
Oh, yeah.
And I could sort of, you know, I have 10,000 cores I'm targeting, or some really abstract thing. Bring it down to some.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure, like, in 50 years, when somebody looks back at the Matrix movies or whatever science fiction representations there are of virtual reality, the thing that they're going to say was the most wrong was that people were spending their time just sort of experiencing the simulation instead of building it. Because what's going to happen is, just like with anything with computers, people become users. They actively do things with it rather than sitting there. And right now we're still, as far as high fidelity gaming, we're still in the era where people are a bit more users than creators, although that's starting to shift.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that a lot of what goes on in virtual worlds will be indistinguishable from programming, or the use and the creation of virtual worlds won't be distinguishable.
Excellent, man.
Yeah.
So... it's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about, you've criticized sort of the modern kind of Web 2.0, you know, Wikipedia and Hive mentality, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
yeah,
that's sort of old news. You started doing that back in, what, 2004, 2003?
Whatever. Oh, no. Well, it depends how you want to count it. Way before that, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what you're talking about there. I mean, what's
going on? Okay. So I think we made a big mistake. And when I say we, I really am owning up to the fact that I was part of the mistake. Because I was, I played a role in the creation of the ideology that I'm criticizing now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's roll back. Some history is important here. The first person to think about the web was Ted Nelson. And Ted invented the idea of the link. He invented the idea that instead of just having a single document you'd look at, you'd have things that connected together online in one way or another. You'd have clusters of things, reuse, things, all kinds of stuff. And he mapped out an approximate picture of the web back in the 1960s. But he did it with one crucial difference versus what happened, which is he imagined a world in which there'd be only one copy, one logical copy of each document, very much as there's only one logical copy of everything on the iTunes store or one logical copy of your profile on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So of course, there are local caches to make it run, but there'd be only one logical copy. And then whoever owned it, if it was owned by anybody, could charge whatever they wanted for access, and the market would sort that out so the whole thing would work.
Mm.
And then masses and masses of people could earn a bit of living from their hearts and their minds by being expressive over the net. This is before it was called the Internet.
Interesting.
In fact, it was before even... it's interesting if you think about it. It was before the ARPANET even.
Hmm.
It's pretty wild. But he was thinking this way. So then what happened was in the 70s and the 80s, there were two very strong reactions against Ted's idea, which was the only one on the table. One of them came from Marxists and Maoists and the sort of campus left of the time. A lot of people who are, say, in their 20s now don't realize what a factor that used to be.
Hmm.
Like, if you look at Fox News and you wonder, how did they get so excitable about this stuff that doesn't even seem to be around? It's because it was around, but it sort of isn't anymore. Yeah. What they were upset about is that Ted wanted to include money in the information universe. Mm. And they're saying money is evil, money is part of capitalism, bad, 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 bad. Should be based on volunteerism and collectivity and everything. And they used to yell at him mercilessly. It was really bad. And then the other kind of critic was the person who was the skeptic of human nature, who was like, you don't realize that almost everyone is really dull, has nothing to share, they're all lazy, they want to sit on the couch, they don't want to participate, they don't want to do anything.
Hmm.
They just want to be fed like an IV, media stuff like TV, the way they are now, which is what used to be the only thing people experienced of technological media. And those two criticisms were the big active ones. So when Tim Berners-Lee started HTML and it took off, all of a sudden millions of people volunteered and did stuff online. So all of the skeptics of human nature got disproved. That happened in the 90s. So that's dead.
Good.
We know that millions of people want to do stuff. Many of us always believed it. That I always believed. I knew that for mm-hmm. sure. I used to say everybody's a genius in some particular way. And I still believe that. But the other stuff kind of weirdly morphed, the sort of Maoism of the 60s and 70s morphed into the libertarianism of the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing is that in the purely abstract world of information, Maoism and libertarianism are the same thing. Right? So you have this very bizarre transformation where you have these people who think they're libertarians who are saying, no, you know, if somebody... But they're actually acting like Maoists, because what they're doing is they're slapping down and reducing the number of business plans you can have. And this is something that just drives me nuts. But anyway, a lot of this started because of a guy named Richard Stallman. And
yes.
Weirdly, I was right. I was in the very rooms where all these things happened, just by coincidence. I remember being with Richard Stallman when he went through this incredible emotional meltdown about some software for a thing called the Lisp machine and said, no, I'm going to just start making software to give out with the source code and everything. And at that very moment, I said to him, but wait a second, if you do that, and he was saying, I'm going to copy Unix and make a free Unix. And I was like, Unix is really dull. We are talking 30 years ago or something. I said, Unix is the dullest thing in the world, because mm-hmm. at that time, like, it was already associated with like old 70s software.
Sure.
And it's the dullest thing in the world. Like, what idealism is more important to you? Is it more interesting to make software that really pushes it and really pushes what software can be, what people can be? Or is the politics behind how the software is written more important to you, and therefore you're going to use this dull old crap from the 70s, mm-hmm. with all respect to Cunningham and Ritchie and everybody. It was great at the time, but... he chose politics over code, basically. And ever since then, there have been all these unbelievably dull copycat open source project. Like, now they want to make an open source Facebook. And I'm like, no, make something better than Facebook.
Yes.
It's like the same mistake again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And so out of those things, enter Sergey Brin.
Yes.
And so Sergey is great. I just think he's actually grown up now, but I still think of him as being this younger kid I used to know, who's just super cute and really, really incredibly bright and organized and energetic. And so he came up with this thing of like, okay, we'll give everything away, but then we'll sell the advertising because we'll have all this information we can use to enhance advertising. Now, what's wrong with that? There's a couple of things that are really bad about that model. And with all respect to Google, there are many people I admire there, mm-hmm. and I think they do know how to write some code, and I'm, you know,
of course,
all that. But mm-hmm. what's wrong with it? One is there's a lot of natural monopolies that happen in the software world because of the sort of sharp cutoff of the nature of compatibility and the enhanced network effect. So eBay's kind of one kind of natural monopoly, and Amazon's another one. And a lot of times when you see competitors, they really are different niches. And mm-hmm. Microsoft, what can I say? But yeah. That's been adjudicated. the problem with the advertising thing is that it makes the person who owns the server into something like the NSA. You turn into this spy agency where you collect like these dossiers on everybody.
Yes.
And then you sell to the highest bidder access to people. And what's wrong? So first of all, it makes a natural monopoly. So, mm-hmm. and if you want proof of that, look at Facebook. I mean, they've collected so much data on people that they're at the point of publishing everybody's genitals or something, mm-hmm. and they still can't lure the ad business away from Google. Mm-hmm. It's like, how far do they have to go? No amount of data will do it because Google's got a lock on it. There's one of these natural monopoly things. That's an eBay-like thing. It's very hard for it. Now, maybe Facebook can do it. If anybody can, maybe they can. But I'm not sure they can.
Well, they've started some advertising on Facebook, I have noticed.
And it is related to your But it's still just behavior. A trickle.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a trickle.
Exactly.
The point is Google's still making the money. So the whole Facebook thing is just like this bizarre exercise in futility. we'll get to Facebook again. But you get this monopoly. So you're sort of creating this private version of the NSA. And I made a joke a while ago at a conference, which is that we're Americans. We don't trust the government. We think the government's incompetent, so we need private industry to spy on us. You know? and that's kind of what we've done with Google and Facebook. And then the other thing that's wrong with it, of course, is this long-term future of how people make a living. So, and this is a whole other long discussion, but going way back to the 19th century, people noticed this problem that as technology improves, you have this choice. Either you say, well, that means we're going to design things so that people get ever more cerebral and more favorable jobs running the higher technology. So when the old jobs get obsoleted because robots can do it, there's mm-hmm. new jobs for people that are even better. Mm-hmm. Or we just say automation will eventually make a lot of people obsolete. If you say the latter thing, well, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. That's where H.G. Wells' The Time Machine came from. All these wonderful 19th century dystopias come from this idea that if machines are really going to make people's jobs obsolete, then society is going to go really bad. Something very bad will happen. But instead what happened thus far is that whenever somebody's job goes obsolete, some more cerebral thing comes up. So the Luddites lost their jobs because of better looms, but then their grandchildren learned to program looms, right? But the Google idea which is also the open culture idea. I mean, Google funds stuff like Firefox precisely because this all works together. This way of thinking says that the actual products of your heart and your mind are to be given away so a third party can make money for selling access to you based on the dossier that is built as a result. Mm. And right now we think that's okay because we advertise ourselves as well. But there's a certain point where that starts to go away. So just the simple example I like to give is right now sometimes you'll hear some people tell a band, okay, you can't make money from selling your recordings, but sell the T-shirt. But what happens when there's a really cheap self-reproducing robot that can make t-shirts off of designs on the net? Then you can't sell the t-shirt anymore either. And that's like this wave that'll go through society. And more things that we do now that involve ways of selling the products of our hearts and our brains will become demonetized if this model is the one that we carry into the future. Mm-hmm. And you just can't sustain. It's really a bad model. What we should have instead is Ted's original model, where people can buy and sell things based on their hearts and brains, so everybody can gradually take on a more cerebral or more information generation-based way of making a living instead of making that all free. Mm. That's the only way to make a long-term stable society. So that's another big problem with it. And then if you want to get another problem...
Too many problems, man.
To me, the economic debacle is just the financial mirror of what happened with Google and Facebook in society. So if your idea of how to use computers and finance is you just put a computer in the middle of the economy to become the spy agency to figure out ways to pull money out of the system, there's no benefit to the system of that. You're not distributing risk. You're not adding intelligence to investment. You're just pulling money out, and then eventually it breaks, which is what happened. Mm. So to me, the hedge fund computers and Google and the NSA are all versions of each other, with NSA being the one that's functional and the other two being dysfunctional. And I can be critical of the NSA too, but at least there's a reason for it. The other two are basically, they seem short-term smart, and they certainly benefit some people to an insane degree. They both have natural monopoly qualities, and in the long term, they're absolutely not sustainable.
Interesting. So let me ask you a question. I mean, because I was thinking about that in terms of read some of the things you've written in that regard. I mean, what do you think about sort of things like, you know, Wolfram Alpha, where he actually, Stephen Wolfram, wants to make knowledge computable. And so, of course, he looks for computable knowledge that you can actually build math around such that the results he returns make sense. But I mean, there's no advertising model there. It's strictly, at least yet, I mean, I don't know what he'd be planning there, but what do you think about that concept? Let's talk about that very concept, the concept of computational knowledge.
Well, I mean, there are things I like about Alpha and things I don't like, but on the whole, I like it, and I think they ought to be able to find a way to charge for it. I mean... To the degree it comes to rely on advertising will be a measure of its failure, basically.
Interesting.
I mean, like, this is, like, so obvious. If Google was really good, there wouldn't be any space to pay for an ad to get something better out of it. Like, you'd already get the result. Like, if there was a search engine that was perfect, we can use Bing, just to not be biased here. If Bing gave you absolute, like, if you got on Bing and you said, you know what, you have some profile info on me, I want to buy a camera, what's the perfect camera? And then it came to you and it produced this 2,000-word essay on precisely why this particular camera was ideal for you based on all the others, and it was just a totally compelling argument and got you the very best deal on it, and it all happened like that. Who's going to have, there's no space to buy an ad. If the thing's really unbiased, then it's done. Or if there was some crowd wisdom thing where there was some kind of wiki something or other, that if any of these things really worked, the only reason that the Google model is even possible is because there's a space between the real and the ideal. Now, the thing about Alpha, and this gets to another thing about Google, which is funny. So way back when Google was just starting, when they were in these little temporary offices, I made a joke that the real innovation of Google was to remove the baseline from judging the performance of software. And what I mean by that is that if you have a program and you want to say, well, how often does this thing crash, you can measure that. And you can measure how fast a search engine returns a result, which Google was always very concerned with and very proud of their speed. But what you can't do is you can't say how good is the result because there's no baseline. There's this total subjectivity.
Sure.
And another great demo of this is these studies that have been done where you swap the brand names behind search results from Bing and Google and whatever. And people really have a hard time telling where it came from without the brand there. So the thing is, there's this real subjectivity. People are pretending they're smarter than they are. And anyway... It's in this ambiguity that the space for this advertising business, I don't even like calling it advertising, it's more like paid access. It's almost like it's basically saying, hey, I know where the people you want to find are, you pay me or you won't find them. There's a kind of the transaction is different from regular advertising. It's not like, it's shifted into something else, and that's another question. But getting back to Wolfram Alpha, the way it's defined is not so subjective. it has objective value. It's saying, I'm going to generate this tide chart for you. I'm going to generate real information about this element for you. And it's also objective that, in a sense, it doesn't have enough of a nonsense factor to have an advertising model. But I also think it has enough value that I could charge for its results. So,
sure.
So I think it might evolve in a different way.
Interesting. I mean, I could see, you know, essentially, what is the distance from Earth to the Crab Nebula? Wolfram Alpha sends down a number to you and gives you some information, and then next to it is an ad for intergalactic travel or interstellar travel with, you know, the work that's being done by Sir Bronson. Anyway, I'm just kidding. So let me let me go back down to, I want to really talk to you about, we've done a lot of stuff already with cultural and digital coevolution. In some sense, software legacy, I want to get back into software. Of course, Channel 9 is, you know, we're a bunch of developers and engineers who come and watch and debate and learn. You're, we're, of course, have the history of being a rather phenomenal software engineer back in the days when you first started your first company.
Yeah, I know, it's funny.
I mean, we should talk
sadly,
about that.
Sadly, in my case, I just turned 50 and I'm not the coder I once was. I really have to, like, I mean, I remember when I was 18, I think I was pretty scary.
You were shredding.
Yeah. I really was.
That's awesome, man.
And so that's just the way it goes.
But let's talk about that. I mean, when you were 18, the software was in a current state, right? I mean, there was a state of tooling and language and capability. Now here we are. You're 50, so 32 years later. Yet you still see this sort of relative kind of legacy. So I picture like the software evolution and the evolution of the digital world as, you know, somebody walking with a big weight on one leg trying to get somewhere because of the legacy of software. You mentioned Unix.
Yeah.
70s.
I mean,
what's
Unix,
going on?
My God, I just can't believe. I can't believe we're dealing with Unix. It's almost, I mean, some stuff gets better and some stuff doesn't. I mean, so, for instance, we have expectations now that personal computers won't crash all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool,
yeah.
You know, and that didn't used to be true. So there's some stuff that definitely gets better.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of development is not as different as people think, but it's definitely different.
Mm.
And I think a lot of the tools are actually better. The availability of libraries for a lot of things is definitely something that's better than it used to be, and so that's all for real. But the basic game is still the same, and I think it's going to change. I think the changes in the future will be far more profound than the ones we've experienced so far.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, and I also don't think, I mean, software is not improving at anything like a Moore's law, although it'd be hard to know exactly how to measure that. But I don't like, you know, if chips are a million times faster, the development of a particular program at most is somewhat faster. I mean, it's certainly not a million.
Yeah.
I doubt it's 10 times.
Sure.
It might be, but that's...
And that's because of software and what software is capable of doing.
Well, it's because software... The difference between software and hardware is that you can draw a box around the edge of hardware. So the thing about hardware is you perfectly define the periphery of what this hardware thing is, and so you can perfectly define what should happen in the inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Software is always touching this mysterious thing we called reality, and so you never can know in advance all the circumstances that'll hit it. You can never cover all the cases, whereas you can with hardware. You can narrow it down.
Certainly.
You can really, yeah, so that's really what it's all about. That's what the difference is, and that's why Moore's Law is possible ultimately. And I know some people say, well, that's all about materials and physics and everything, but it's ultimately variations on the same idea that you're dealing with a highly specified problem, and so you can benefit from your learning curve within it. And this gets back to what I was saying about software, that you can never really describe what a program is supposed to do, so software is just a different kind of game.
Absolutely.
More open-ended, and that makes all the difference.
So, and the question I'd ask you, because you're also a big fan of mathematics, and you also tend to be a relativist in the Feyerabian sense, Paul Feyerabend.
Oh, that's interesting.
I would look at you definitely as more of a relativist. But let me ask you a question, and that is...
Not so sure. It's interesting. It's an interesting question, but go ahead. So he used to live down the street from me in Berkeley.
So have you talked to him? I mean, did you?
No, I never met him.
He's my idol, one of my idols.
I know a lot of people who knew him. Okay. A lot of them at the time were young women who he would drag to wrestling matches.
Oh, man. Interesting.
Yeah.
But his philosophy is quite interesting, his intellect. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mathematics, is it the language of the universe? And why would you say that? I mean, do you think mathematics is capable of describing precisely?
Okay, here's the thing about math.
Yes.
Some arbitrarily weird and different alien of some kind would not discover math that contradicts ours, but might discover math that doesn't overlap ours. Hmm. So the particular nature of the universality of math is not the intuitive sense of universality that we have with everyday objects. It's a different kind of universe. It is universal, but in a much... In a non-guaranteed way, because we don't know if there'd be overlap. Hmm. So I'm not at all convinced that aliens would have integers. Okay. I don't know that they'd start by counting. Lisa Mullen and I once worked out some aliens that lived in a topological space where they're floating in this sort of gaseous world, and they form these knots and connections. And it never occurs to them to count.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
They never have the notion of an ordered series of integers. It just doesn't happen. So that's imaginable. So you could end up with such diverse islands of mathematics that they never actually touch, and you'd never know how far they are from touching. So in that sense, you could have two civilizations with very good mathematicians that would have nothing in common at all. So there's no guarantee of universality, but there's a possibility of it.
Interesting.
And so it's a very particular.
So yeah. Let's go back to my initial sort of random and impromptu introduction to that question, back to Fire Robin and sort of the philosophy of science. Would you consider yourself, I guess basically what he was arguing against was the notion of absolute objectivity, that's just a crock, right? And was also arguing against sort of the mechanistic nature of scientists before him and of course his peers. So let's talk. I mean, what kind of thoughts do you have in that area?
All right. The first thing I want to say is that this is hard.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone fully understands this yet, and it's also hard to talk about because if you so much as whisper any doubts about the foundations of the philosophy of science, then you sort of worry that a whole army of idiots who are the global climate change denialists or something or the anti-evolution people or whatever are going to sort of storm. And so it's hard to talk about. So my personal view is that we know just a few things. I think we can count on mathematical proof being real, or being, you know, sturdy, I guess is the word I'd use.
Okay.
We can count on that being, because if we don't do that, then we're nowhere. Like, we have to start somewhere.
Okay.
We can count on bodies of empirical result theories organizing the results that have withstood some number of attacks as being not quite as sturdy, but pretty sturdy.
Mm-hmm.
We can count on overall conceptions of the world that unify those theories as being maybe a little less sturdy, but still pretty sturdy. And so to me, there's sort of this hierarchy of sturdiness, which is what I try to base my thinking on, but none of it, you know, without requiring an absolute certainty. The things that are sturdier along that hierarchy are pretty sturdy indeed. But it's an interesting question. So I have one friend named Julien Barbour, who's a wonderful relativist, a theoretical physicist, who believes time doesn't exist and is in a way the ultimate absolutist, because if the future's already written and time is just laid out as these beads in another dimension, then there's no room for variation. You know, it's the ultimate determinism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have another friend, Emily Smolin,
yep,
who is, in a sense, the opposite, who thinks that the laws of nature themselves evolve and that the whole system of reality is this thing without constants that's always changing. but slowly. And if it was going quickly, he'd talk himself out of a job pretty fast, right?
Absolutely.
So those are these two things, and I'm a bit more of I start from the point of view of human experience, and I start from internal experience in my epistemology. So I tend to sort of ask the questions, well, what can we really know? And I end up with this sort of idea of the hierarchy of sturdiness rather than really positioning myself at one end or the other. But I think instead there's sort of like these, or if you like, you can think of it as like this, these shells that surround us of varying degrees of knowability. Mm. And at present, I don't think there's any way to really resolve this question and to know whether Julian is more right or Lee is more right.
Sure. But it's an interesting thing to think about for sure. Mm-hmm. Now,
yeah.
Music. Why isn't music communication? Is music just a form of communication?
Well,
not just a form. Is it a form of communication?
Music's kind of a mystical thing because it's this universal human experience. Every culture has it, but we can't quite define it. Nobody's ever come up with a satisfactory definition that covers exactly all the things we mean by music.
Okay. So it's not mathematical.
So we're not quite sure what it is. It overlaps with everything. I mean, one way to think about it is in terms of neuroscience. And so if you look at the parts of the brain that light up in fMRI when you're listening to music or making music, it is this sort of synesthetic or the multimodal parts of the brain. It does connect to everything, both physiologically and in terms of ideas, naturally enough. So it connects with math, obviously. And there are a lot of people who are good at math or programming are also musicians. But it also connects with dance, with this other very physical stuff. It connects with human power struggles, like, you know, rappers and gangsters who've always played this huge role in music in all cultures. It connects with everything. So I think of it as this activity that's right in the center of human experience, maybe the most central thing.
Interesting.
I can't think of any other thing in human experience that connects to it connects to spirituality, to sexuality, to everything. And nothing else is quite like that. Music really stands alone for that, in that centrality, I think. And I don't know quite what it is. My attitude towards music is that I love it so much that, and it seems to work fine without me thinking about it a lot. So I don't approach it as intellectually as I do a lot of other things. I don't really think about it all that much, and that disappoints people sometimes. But as a musician, I'm much more of a sort of an intuitive kind of person, and not so much a nerd as I am in other things. I really just kind of play.
Good. And you play a lot of instruments.
Yeah. And with all kinds of people. I just did a show with Yoko Ono that was unlike anything I've done in a long time. It was really fun.
What instrument were you playing in?
All kinds of different things. We just worked out some, we went to the studio the day before and showed some instruments. I did these duets with her where she was doing her vocalizations and I was playing different things, and it was actually really good. It really came out kick-ass.
Excellent.
Yeah, at the Fox Theater in Oakland.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. So now, of course, you live in Silicon Valley, right?
Well, Berkeley.
You're in Berkeley.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you have...
I mean, I did live in Palo Alto in the 80s, so I caught an earlier... I lived in the middle of it during an earlier incarnation. Yeah, Berkeley is... You can call Berkeley Silicon Valley. Berkeley as the university, California Berkeley, has probably spawned more businesses without the community benefiting from it than any other because of the sort of bizarre sort of socialist environment around Berkeley that doesn't allow anybody to do a business. So it's very strange. So it's, in a way, it's the anti-Silicon Valley where we send all of our good, all the students who become good entrepreneurs end up either in Silicon Valley and some of them in Redmond even.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Couple pretty good. So speaking of Ian Redmond, I mean, you've been working at Microsoft. I mean, you work here since 2009.
Yeah.
And you're working in sort of the Extreme Computing Group under Dan Reed, who's been on Channel 9 before. Mm-hmm. What's it been like for you to work for Microsoft?
There are a couple things I should say.
Please.
The first thing is that all these ideas, obviously I'm speaking for myself and not for Microsoft, and I'm sure there are various things I say that would just terrify or horrify somebody in marketing or some lawyer or something, and that's just... But there's a very interesting story behind that.
Yeah.
So I got involved with Microsoft initially not as an employee at all, but as a... I was called the scholar at large for a few years. And what had happened is Google bought this company that had been called iMatic and then Nevin Vision, which is a machine vision company. Mm-hmm. And everybody from it, including a wonderful, wonderful physicist and engineer named Hartmut Nevin, went to Google. And Hartmut now is their head of machine vision. And at that time, and needless to say, we went through a bankruptcy just beforehand, so none of us became rich in the way we might have imagined, because they were just, I'm a master at that, of like just barely skirting, making a lot of money from something in Silicon Valley. But anyway, so they all went there. And I thought naturally I would just go there too. And this problem came up at Google, which is that Google doesn't let their employees speak freely. Like you can't blog and say something that might be interpreted as being critical of Google. You can't go write controversial stuff as a Googler. They really clamp down on it.
Okay.
And Apple's even worse. Right about that time, I got a call from Sinofsky and also from Ray Ozzie. And Ray said, you know what, come up and talk to us before you make a decision. Mm. It's like completely surprised. So I came up and, you know, one of the first questions I asked is, I write these controversial essays. I have these opinions. Do you guys care? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, it's great. Just make it clear that you're speaking for yourself and not for us, or else there'll be trouble. Mm-hmm. And that really impressed me. Like, this is the only large company that actually lets people both, you know, do their work and also have a voice.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I'm certainly, the stuff I say is as controversial. I mean, I don't know anybody else who's more controversial in the community than me. And they don't care. And that's amazing. That's amazing. And that really turned, I have to say, I mean, I used to have the worst anti-Microsoft jokes. Mm. I mean, I was really pretty upset in like the 90s. Mm-hmm. Like a lot, you know, but that just totally turned me around. I realized, you know, this is really an interesting thing here. This is like a, gradually warmed to it more and more.
Cool.
So that's the story.
Well, that's good. Well, I mean, I'm sure you're doing some really creative things and working on some hard problems.
What are the problems? So obviously there's this issue of like how to program big computers, which nobody knows how to do. We'd really like, that's basically the thing we want to do. I mean, like pushing VR still.
Yeah.
One of the great things about Microsoft is Xbox. So
yes.
So the thing about Xbox is that there's no other organization in the world that could do Natal. No one else would really put that together, because that's a huge amount of work, and that's a very, very cool thing. And I'd had a chance to do some work with depth cameras in VR when they were much earlier, and just like to see that actually getting out to consumers is amazing. Mm-hmm. Two, Xboxes talk to each other; they're networked personal simulators. Like that exists in the world. That's amazing. That's amazing, yeah. And that's an incredible combination. There's nothing else like that. So that's a pretty big deal. I mean, I'm really interested in where Xbox is going to go. Like, if you project where the community is now of Xbox users, like, to 10 years or 20 years, that could become something just really astonishing and really interesting. Mm.
The final note would be, what are your thoughts on sort of the coevolution of humanity and the digital world? And now, because it is humanity, or human beings, so people write software.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the sort of the science fiction people, you know, would like to reverse that in that software writes people. Mm-hmm. So I want to know in the future, I mean, what's your thinking? I mean, we're so early on in general purpose computing. I mean, it's only been around for, what, 50 years, 60 years?
Yeah.
Big deal.
Yeah.
So that's nothing in terms of evolutionary time.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you see, like, when you think back and sit back, when you do have some free time, and you clearly are a very thoughtful person, what's going on here? How do you see us co-evolving with the digital world and driving it and being driven by it at the same time?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't object to technology having some evolutionary quality to it. I object to it not being human-centered, because then it's sort of a form of slow suicide. If we define our technology as replacement for ourselves, we're choosing slow suicide, and we don't have to. I'll give you an example. Right now, if if you talk about an adaptive user experience, typically what you're talking about is somebody who collects all the spy data on you from Facebook or Twitter or something, and then tries to create this interface for you. That's, but the thing is, you're not the customer. You're not the user. You're the used.
Yes.
Okay.
And fair enough.
So you're the used. The real customer is somebody off to the side who's bidding to get access to you, when perhaps in the past they didn't even have to pay as much. That's another interesting story. I think there's a coercive element to that. The whole thing to me is ugly. Mm. And here's an alternative. What if you had, you're driving a car, and the controls of the car, maybe they can automate a bit for to save energy and avoid collisions and all that. But if you're driving it, what if they're sort of robotic and they conform themselves to your body and there's a feedback loop where they test a little bit, they change things and see if you drive better as a result. So as the thing evolves, you become a better and better driver, and it also becomes a better and better user interface for you based on instant feedback. Now that's an imaginable design, which is actually human-centered. That's a design that says you're the important one, mm-hmm. as opposed to a design that says this third party who's, you know, being coerced into paying money for access to you is the important one. Because if you follow that thing to its conclusion, it really does become anti-human.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the real question is it human-centric or not? Is it about people?
Excellent. Awesome.
Okay.
On that note,
it's great. Hey, no, that's a wonderful
okay,
way
cool,
to
cool,
end
cool.
this. And thank you so much for your time.
Mm-hmm.
And great to meet you.
Super, super cool.
Right
I'm glad to be here.
Hopefully we can see you back on Channel 9 one of these days.
Sure, just invite me.
Thank you.